Hello, I'm Tommy Sharp and welcome to the Beveridge Report, a student-led podcast run out of the LSE Department of Economics. This week, we head to the Bank of England for a conversation with Professor Silvana Tenreiro. Silvana is a Professor of Economics at LSE, sits on the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England, and has a variety of other distinguished roles in economics. Previously, we have discussed the financial crash within a variety of institutions. Silvana discussed with us some of the fundamentals of the Bank of England, monetary policy, and shocks like Brexit and the coronavirus, as well as topics like women and economics. This analysis was recorded before the LSE or indeed anything else closed because of COVID, so the analysis will reflect this.
So, in today's episode, we'll be talking more broadly about monetary policy and the role of the bank before considering three current issues, Brexit, the coronavirus outbreak, and the lack of sort of women in the field of economics. Firstly, Silvana, with regards to monetary policy, the 2008 crisis was the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, and yet after it, inflation and unemployment have been quite stable. Would you say we've cracked monetary policy?
I wouldn't quite put it that way. The 2008 financial crisis was a terrible event for many people. Many people lost jobs, houses, savings, and wages and productivity growth have grown little since then. So economists and policymakers had to think hard about the discipline and ways to in which we could have done better. Now, having said that, I think the response of monetary policy was good, and central banks were willing to do all that it takes to combat the crisis. So unemployment did fall back, and policymakers were able to keep inflation averaging close to their targets, despite the fact that we saw some very big shocks since then as well. So I think there were many lessons to learn. Monetary policy reacted well, but we learned also about prevention of crises, and that led to big changes in many countries.
So I'm interested with regards to the sort of new introduction of unconventional monetary policy post-financial crash. The Fed chairman has recently said they have a mandate to like gradually normalize monetary policy again. If everything has been so stable and we've been quite good at monetary policy post-financial crash, should QE be part of a more normalised policy remit?
Well, just to clarify, the Fed mandate is to achieve price stability and full employment. The idea about normalising rates is where he expected rates to move in order to achieve the mandate, but there's no mandate to normalise rates. Now, one thing we've learned through research is that today, equilibrium real interest rates are much lower than they used to be, and this is due to demographic changes. We have a much older population, women are having fewer children, etc., etc. And on top of that, productivity growth has been slower. We have a higher incidence of tail risk shocks, and all of that means that real interest rates are now lower, and hence, given our mandates of around 2% inflation for many central banks, that means that nominal interest rates will tend to be lower. Now, with regards to QE, given that we're very close to zero lower bounds or effective lower bounds, it's true that QE will become more of a regular in our toolkit and less, you know, less unconventional, given that it would be part of our regular toolkit.
So now we're going to talk a little bit about the role of the Bank of England and in the political context that the bank falls into. The bank was made independent in 1997 with the justification that it means monetary policy can no longer be used for political means. We see the damage of this across the world. One implication of this is that monetary policy now operates independently of fiscal policy. So post-crash, you have George Osborne pursuing austerity while the central bank is expanding and lowering interest rates. How do we reconcile these two policies that seem quite contradictory?
Fiscal policy has a broader mandate than monetary policy, and it operates at different horizons. For us, mandate is to sustain price stability and stabilize growth and employment within a much shorter period of time. The judgment when the austerity plan was launched was that the government needed to return public finances to what it viewed as a sustainable path. So that was a much longer term consideration. And given that decision, then obviously it was up to monetary policy to do most of the stabilization in the shorter term. So there's no contradiction in that sense, and we operate independently outside crisis time. In crisis time, you might need to, you know, resort to exceptional coordination that would require thinking together about solutions.
So another question in regards to the independence of the bank. The justification of independence is that it means politics can't really interfere with the running of the economy. But what happens when you have the running of the economy requiring decisions with a bit of a political flavour, such as state money going into investment banks and banks to ease the running of the economy? Do you think something that's kind of quasi-fiscal should be left in the hands of the bank?
Fiscal decisions or quasi-fiscal decisions, you know, are obviously are not up to the bank. Bank bailouts back in 2009 with the crisis were in the hands of the Treasury, not the bank. The bank had nothing to do with those bank bailouts. The bank's response to the crisis, the monetary policy response, obviously was with interest rates and with QE. But QE is not giving money to investment bankers. It's about the purchase of assets, mostly gilts at the time, which were almost exclusively outside the banking sector. So there was no money given by the bank to investment bankers.
And lastly, on the sort of more broad role of the bank, do you think there's a role for the bank to kind of debunk fake news? So if a political campaign were saying things that were clearly untrue, does the bank have a responsibility to step in and say that the economics of that doesn't actually work?
I think the bank should stay neutral on political debates. There are many other ways to fight fake news. And I think the bank has already its hands full with its responsibilities, and that should be carried out outside the bank.
Cool, thanks so much. We're now briefly going to talk about a few of the more current issues in the world. The first we'll talk about is Brexit. So since the financial crash, there have been lots of shocks to the British economy, one of the largest being Brexit. In the post-Brexit referendum in August 2016, the bank wrote a report saying they'd increased inflation forecast beyond 2%, which it hadn't done for the previous couple of years. Why was this a big deal, and why did Brexit call for these inflation forecasts to be increased?
Well, that was before my time in the MPC, but I think the MPC had inflation forecasts above or below 2% in the past. What the MPC faced in 2016 was a big trade-off. The exchange rate had depreciated significantly at the time by 15%. That was going to feed into inflation. But at the same time, the increase in uncertainty meant that investment was going to suffer and hence activity, overall activity. So the MPC faced a trade-off, how to balance higher inflation with lower activity. And within its remit, it could accommodate that by returning inflation to its target in a longer horizon than the usual one. And the judgment at the time was that would be, you know, the right balance to extend a bit the period of inflation above target to save jobs and support growth in the economy.
Cool. So do you think the increasing of inflation forecast was mainly to do with sort of short-term things like, as you said, the kind of fear around investment and the drop in exchange rates, or was it more to do with the fear of like cost push inflation in the future with tariffs?
This was effectively the exchange rate shock was a cost push inflation, I mean, combined with the uncertainty spike. So that was a cost push inflation, to put it in the, you know, textbook framework.
And so the bank uses this policy of like forward guidance, which has been quite an important thing post crisis in like the monetary policy world, wherein the bank states that in 12 months we'll make interest rates 2%. And so you can influence long-term rates as well as like overnight rates. But one of the things about it is the bank has to stick to its promise. When Brexit provides a large like risk of cost push inflation, you have a bit of a difficulty where you have a trade-off between sticking to the promise you've made in forward guidance or changing the rates. So the bank, I think, mostly decided to stick to its promise. Why was this initially seen as like the more optimal decision as opposed to raising the rates with cost push inflation?
Just to clarify, the MPC has never done forward guidance in the sense of committing to an interest rate path. What the guidance that the MPC has given was always about conditions, or what conditions might cause an increase in rates or a decrease in rates, and at what pace, but never committing to a given move or path. So it was mostly about explaining its reaction function and how it would move rates in response to different economic conditions. And that's helpful for the public and companies to understand where the economy is moving and what would be the reaction of the central bank to those movements.
Yeah, interesting. So now we're going to talk a bit about coronavirus. This is obviously the talking point of the world at the moment. In a recent Start of the Week podcast, Mervyn King said, the most important challenges that we face are when things happen that we just didn't anticipate. Coronavirus is clearly one of these events. What has sort of been the response from the bank with regards to the shock facing our economy currently?
Well, as you heard this week, the bank has decided to lower interest rates by 50 basis points, and together with that it launched a program, the Term 4 funding scheme, to support small and medium enterprises, the TFS-ME, and that's to help ensuring that the fall in interest rate is passed through into loan rates for businesses and households. So this is the stimulus part of the package done by the MPC. In turn, the FPC, the Financial Policy Committee, has decided to lower its countercyclical buffers, so allowing banks to lend possibly more and relaxing the capital constraints. So altogether, this will give support to the economy and contribute to help bridging the impasse between now and the time in which the economy returns to its normal supply capacity.
So yesterday, the head of the European Central Bank warned that there could be a crash on the same sort of scale as the 2008 crash. How do you think the nature of the threat compares?
The key question is how prepared the financial system is to face the shock. In the UK, and this is what changed since the crisis, the banking system is in a much stronger position right now to face a crisis. And I'm not sure what Ms. Lagarde was referring to in her remarks, and perhaps her concerns had to do with financial stability in the euro area, and obviously that could be a concern.
So lastly, to move on to sort of talking about women in economics, you're obviously one of the most prestigious economists at LSE, and as the only woman on the bank's monetary policy committee, do you see yourself as a bit of a role model for women in the economic field?
Well, I like young women to look at me and think, well, if she can do it, I can do it too, definitely. I do believe in role models, and the more we identify with people in different professions and careers, it sort of can make it more relatable and influence people's decisions.
It seems to me that there can be two sort of problems with getting women into the field of economics. One, that not enough women enter the field, and another, that not enough stay in a sort of leaky pipe type phenomenon. If the director of LSE gave you total power tomorrow to sort of fix this problem, do you have any initiatives you think you could introduce, or how might you go about combating this issue?
I think the first thing I would do is to ask the women who left the system or are currently struggling in the system as PhD students or assistant professors, what are the obstacles that they see and how they could be tackled. In some sense, I am one of the lucky ones who was able to cope with the constraints in the system, but maybe we should rethink those constraints and understand what was difficult for other women and how we can change that so that more women can be part of the profession. Second thing, if I were the LSE director, I would appoint an ombudsman and have a clear system so that women facing problems, harassment, bullying, or any form of obstacles can discuss that with the ombudsman and try to work out the solution. I would also ensure that there is equality at all levels, at the appointment level, in career progression, promotion, pay, so that it's clear that women have equal opportunities at all levels, and there's no oversight of that. There's plenty of evidence that publication lags are longer for women. There's evidence that all else equal, women get lower teaching evaluations. There are all sorts of unconscious bias that we know exist, and it's very important to educate students, faculty, staff about them and take them into account in making decisions. And fourth, I would invest money to attract and to retain women. We shouldn't be losing them.
Awesome. Just to conclude, I suppose this is a slightly more normative question, but what do you see as sort of the largest and most pressing challenge to the UK economy? Is it these short-term shocks from oil prices or coronavirus, or is it something more inbuilt in the system?
Well, right now the shock we face is coronavirus. That's dominating our discussions, and the key question is what to do to support the economy so that this is just a temporary shock that doesn't escalate or have persistent effects. So that's the absolute urgent problem for us now. And going forward, there are many interesting things to think about, digital currencies, policy tools, et cetera, but those important issues are more for the medium term at the moment. The pressing question is how to react to the crisis, the coronavirus spread.
And this is a question we ask at the end of all of our podcasts. Considering the level of fear in the economy currently, maybe people are feeling quite like frightened. What gives you hope?
Science. the fact that we will find a solution through science. I have an enormous hope in the new generations that are very focused into the important issues of climate change, and they won't let go. And I like that commitment, and I think they are totally into the right thing. So I would say that the young people and science.
Thank you so much, Fana.
And to you, the listener, we thank you for listening, and we hope you tune in again next time.